This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. Natural E has taken a well-deserved day off, so we won't have much news tonight. I did want to share with you that Paul McCartney has stepped up to be the spokesman for the anti-fracking movement in the United Kingdom. Also, as the U.S. announces its carbon-cutting plan, Canada confirms it will do nothing. And that's about all we're going to get into. We have a busy program today. And the calendar we'll have a little later, but it will pretty much just consist of other environmental programs on KKFI. Later on in this evening's program, Richard Mabian will talk to Zach Pistora, the Sierra Club lobbyist, and they'll bring us up to speed on legislative issues with regard to the environment in Kansas. But first, we're going to speak to Audrey Klopper, a Kansas organic farmer and herbalist. And she'll be speaking on the use of quote-unquote biosolids as fertilizer. Audrey Klopper, welcome to Eco Radio KC.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. You've got an interesting story, and we'll allow that to unfold as the show progresses. But your story has prompted you to do quite a bit of history on sewage and sludge and other distasteful things. So we'll start out with maybe you could give us what your research has told you about the history of sewage treatment.
Okay. So in this country, in the olden days, we used primitive systems in our cities to carry human waste from our homes to lakes, rivers, and oceans. And this was basically open pipes and guttering. Then in the late 1900s, we developed sewer systems because we had to get rid of hazardous waste. This was a direct result of increased use of toxic chemicals in our country. In the 1970s, our country was faced with a severe water pollution crisis. You might remember when lakes caught on fire, rivers and lakes, and sewage washed up on beaches.
Mm-hmm.
So thus, in 1972, the Clean Water Act was passed. And a lot of money was allocated to improve the treatment of wastewater systems. However, as these systems became more efficient and the water quality improved, the byproduct, which is sludge, became more and more concentrated and toxic. So I need to clarify the role of a sewage treatment plant. The sewage plant does not remove the toxins from the sludge, but rather it concentrates them in the sludge. For about 20 years, we dumped this toxic sludge in the ocean. It's 100 miles offshore. But then this region became a dead zone. So essentially, we killed all life 100 miles offshore. So in 1992, the Ocean Dumping Act was passed by Congress, and this banned the ocean dumping of sewage sludge. Well, it had to go somewhere, right? Now, at this point in time, half of all municipal sludge in the U.S. is applied to land. That's 8 million tons a year. And this is sanctioned by the Departments of Health and Environment and by the EPA. Strict standards were developed in 1989 by the EPA for land application of sludge, but these standards were relaxed in 1992 because of pressure from industry. So Section 503 of the Clean Water Act amendments were passed, which allowed higher levels of heavy metals in sludge applied to soil. Sludge was then reclassified as a Class A fertilizer. Prior to this, it was considered a hazard waste, and it was not even allowed in landfills. But now at this point, it's a fertilizer. And a $1 million or more than $1 million PR campaign began. And toxic sludge became biosolids. There's a whole book. It's called Toxic Sludge is Good for You, and it's all about the PR campaign. So sludge is now being marketed as organic fertilizer. This is how our toxic chemicals are being disposed of. This is so very misleading because by calling it organic, one might presume it is accepted by organic certification standards. But in reality, the use of such a product would jeopardize an organic farm's organic certification process. I'm going to get back to PR for just a minute. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and I put that in quotes, has given millions of our tax dollars to the Water Environmental Federation. Now, this is the lobbying arm and the PR facet of the waste industry. They've done this to promote the spreading of sludge and to discredit and debunk sludge victims and opponents. In 1981, a document was published by the EPA describing persuasive techniques to manipulate public acceptance of sludge. And included in this document were suggestions to target poor farmers. I believe that there's inadequate assessments in terms of the impacts, which are overlooked in the reclassification of the sludge. And namely, it's the impact upon our children who are exposed to sludge, the impact on vital microorganisms in the soil, and the long-term health of the soil.
Okay, can I let me just make sure our listeners understand. When we say sludge, we're basically talking about what gets flushed down our toilets, that where it gets aggregated, and or I guess imagine it's stuff poured down our sink as well. Is that right?
Yes. I have a definition of sludge.
Okay.
And this is from the HarperCollins Dictionary of Environmental Science. Sludge is a viscous semi-solid mixture of bacteria and virus-laden organic matter, toxic metals, synthetic organic chemicals, and settled solids removed from domestic and industrial waste at a sewage treatment plant. So it's a chemical soup.
Okay, and so is it so toxic because of all the chemicals in our diet and things we pour down our drain, or is it just, you know, even under the best of circumstances, is human waste?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I'll get to that. I'll get to that in a second. I'll reveal what's in sludge. Let me tell you that 60% of the sludge now in the U.S. is applied to farmland, playgrounds, and parks. And only 9 elements and 2 bacteria out of hundreds of toxins listed by the EPA are tested to determine if the sludge is safe. The EPA doesn't track health incidents related to sludge and has no cancer risk assessments for the pollutants, although known carcinogens exist in the sludge. There was a Yale University study in 2010 that revealed that sludge is not heated high enough to kill pathogens and that bacteria regrows after treatment after just 20 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. So the 503 biosolids rule standards are not protective of our health and the health of the earth. Some of the allowable EPA limits of chemicals far exceed European legal limits. And even Del Monte, Nestle, and Heinz don't allow sewage sludge to be applied on their farms because of the weak standards. In just a minute, I'm going to get to, well, I'll tell you now. I'll tell you now what's found in the sludge, and then I'll give you some examples of some of the harm that it's done. Okay, so sludge, besides our human waste, there are neurodevelopmental toxins. And these alter brain function. Also present are toxic gases, PBCs, dioxins known to cause birth defects and bioaccumulate in breast milk, endocrine disruptors, chlorinated solvents, bacteria and viruses such as salmonella, hepatitis B, and E. coli, flame retardants, parasites, carcinogens, pesticides, petroleum products, respiratory irritants, airborne particulates, allergens, molds, fungi, caffeine, pharmaceuticals such as antibiotics, estrogen, Prozac, and other antidepressants, and heavy metals which bioaccumulate in our food chain. So we're not just talking about poop. It goes way beyond that, because like the Hunzas, people in Asia have composted their waste for years, and they have they're some of the healthiest people on the planet. But we live in an industrialized society, so our wastes are not very clean. In 1995, a 26-year-old boy named Shane Connor, who lived in Greenland, New Hampshire, died after sludge was applied to a field down the road. The EPA had told the community that the sludge dumping was safe. Many of Shane's neighbors had complained of nosebleeds, cysts, abscesses, and headaches. And they think that airborne pathogens were probably the culprit. In 1996, there was a boy named Tony Behoon. He was age 11 from Osceola Mills, Pennsylvania. And he drove his three-wheeler through a freshly applied field of sludge and died 8 days later.
Wow.
Yeah. In 1994, at the Blue Valley Sewer District in Missouri, workers reported symptoms including respiratory distress, gastrointestinal complaints, fatigue, and irritations. And in Nebraska in 1986, there was a documented case of the death of a sludge worker.
Wow.
In Riverside, California, sewage sludge was used as fertilizer, and residents became sick with flu-like symptoms, respiratory problems, nosebleeds, rashes, asthma. And the Center for Disease Control admitted that life-threatening diseases could result from exposure to sludge dumped on farmland.
Okay, well, that brings me to an interesting question point that I want to make sure our listeners understand. So several years back here in Kansas City, there was a big conversion on how the sewage was treated. And it was touted as a huge success because it saved, an enormous amount of money that the city is paying a fraction of what it used to treat sewage. So what's happening now is, and I'm not sure whether this is with all the sewage, but I personally, as you know, we've talked about this. I visited a place in North Kansas City where it's a farm that is owned by the city, and this sludge or sewage is piped onto this farm for fertilizer. And they told me that what's grown there is not for food but for biofuels and things like that. So I just wanted to make sure our listeners were aware of that. What would you have hoped Kansas City would have done instead?
Oh my goodness! There's a lot of alternatives. There's a lot of hopeful procedures that could be taken. If you don't want me to talk more about the dangers, I can go on to the hopeful aspects. I've got a lot more dangers here. They're putting it on the field, and they're saying that it's not getting in our food chain. Well, that's not true, because a bird will die if they eat earthworms from fields treated with sludge if the level of cadmium is high enough. Because that bioconcentrates in the liver and kidney of animals. So I don't know how they can say that it's not in the food chain.
Well, I don't know that they went that far. They just said it's not – what's being grown there is not food. It's, in other words, it's, for biofuels.
Right. Well, it's really a small planet. Okay, I'll get to the hopeful stuff, and we can come back to the risk if that's okay.
Yeah, before you get to the hopeful stuff, we do have some spots we need to play. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back very quickly with Audrey Klopper, organic farmer and herbalist from Kansas, about toxic sludge. So we'll be right back. Thank you, Audrey.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. On Saturday, June 14th at IBEW Local 124, the Heartland Labor Forum will celebrate 25 years of talking back to the boss with two of our favorite hellraisers, America's number one populist Jim Hightower and labor troubadour Ann Feeney. We'll have a VIP meet and greet dinner at 6 p.m., followed by a hell-raising speech and concert at 7. Details, advance tickets, and directions are available at kkfi.org. We do
the work. On the next From the Vault from Pacifica Radio Archives, we celebrate the 35th anniversary of the Survival Sunday No Nukes Rally at the Hollywood Bowl. Featuring Jackson Brown, Joan Baez, Robin Williams, Lily Tomlin, John Sebastian, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Peter Paul and Mary, Gil Scott-Heron, Ralph Nader, and Helen Caldicott. Set your alarm for 5 a.m. on Wednesday.
I'm Kathy Kelly, and I'm delighted to be in Kansas City, a place where I have such fond memories of the development, really, of alternative radio over decades. And congratulations to all the people at 90.1 FM KKFI Community Radio for maintaining such a fine community of volunteers and activists.
Three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly on the next Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now!
All right, here we are back in Eco Radio KC. My name is Mike Murphy. I'm on the phone with Audrey Clopper talking about toxic sludge, a.k.a. sewage. Okay, so where were we, Audrey?
We were between the dangers of sludge and solutions to the problem. I can go either way.
All right, so are there dangers, other dangers you feel are important that our listeners should know about?
I do. And I don't want to be all doom and gloom because I will get hopeful here, but I think it's important that this information is exposed, if that's okay.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so lead. There's lead in sludge, which can delay a child's development and lower their IQ and impact their bone structure. And mercury is also in sludge, and it's a potential cause of muscular sclerosis, and it's been linked to anxiety and manic depression.
Let me just interrupt you really quick. When you said mercury, that raised, we had Craig Volland on a few weeks ago, and he spoke about how mercury pollution is probably one of the biggest issues facing our environment. And in fact, his talk that he gave at All Souls a couple weeks ago will air this Wednesday at noon. So our listeners may want to tune in and listen to that. So go ahead, Audrey. I'm sorry.
Okay. I was just thinking of being in fifth grade and playing with mercury on the floor of our classroom as a science experiment. Thallium. Thallium's a toxic heavy metal. It's listed as one of the most dangerous potential agents for bioterrorism, yet the EPA does not require sludge to be tested for thallium. There was a farmer in Augusta, Georgia named Bill Boyce who watched his dairy herd die a slow death after he accepted sludge as a fertilizer. And independent testing of his cows revealed high levels of thallium. In Missouri, in 2009, a cluster of brain tumors was linked to sludge application to farmland, and chromium-6 was revealed as a culprit. And it's not just to people. Like I say, it's to the environment. There's hormone-disrupting chemicals. There was a study done with male fathead minnows that were placed in sewage sludge water, and they developed female characteristics. And in 1998, male walleyes were impacted by estrogen-like compounds from a sewage plant near the Mississippi River, and this rendered them sterile. There's no labeling required for food grown in sludge, and like I said, organic standards do not allow the use of food grown in septic sludge.
Okay, now that you've cheered us up, maybe you can give us something to be hopeful about.
Okay, but just one more thing that I need to say that's negative, and then I'll go. There's a man named Jim Bynum that was a farmer in Kansas City, and I spoke with him years ago. He said, if anyone except the government was responsible for this new outbreak of plagues, it would be considered an act of terrorism. And he said, if you're getting runoff from a sludge site, you're getting pathogenic disease organisms, which could be interpreted as bioterrorism. Okay,
said that?
Jim Bynum. He's a farmer that also, in the Kansas City area, that also experienced sludge contamination on his farm.
Okay, all right. So, thanks. All right, so on to the hopeful stuff.
Okay. Well, do you remember when there was the Valdez oil spill?
Sure, 25 years ago.
Yes. So they did this experiment. They did a test plot, and they used oyster mushrooms. They grew oyster mushrooms in the oil. What happened was that the mushrooms synthesized the toxins, made like a brand new ecosystem, so much so that when they tested the oyster mushrooms for oil and contaminants, there was none. So it gives me chills to think that that's magic to me, right? And they've done a lot of studies, and they think that perhaps there's further implications for even nuclear waste. This is called mycoremediation or mycosorption. Mycosorption is when mushrooms sequester toxic materials. So when you treat sludge with fungi, there have been encouraging results, very promising for the future of treating sludge and wastewater. There was a fungi studied called Mucor humilis weimer, and I don't know what the common name of that, but I think that we should put energy into mycoremediation. Mycorrhizas, part of mushrooms, it's a bridge for nutrient transport from the soil to the roots of plants. And in my gardens, I use mycorrhizas to enhance my plant growth, and it's amazing. After the BP oil spill, they used a dispersant, which I think was called Correctex, something like that. They used it to clean, and I put clean in quotes, the water after the Gulf oil spill. But this dispersant was probably more toxic than the oil itself. And I've read accounts of sheep wool soaking up oil. I think sheep farmers could have sent wool, and we could have had a much better result. And then mycoremediation should have been explored, in my opinion.
Something
called phytoremediation that's using plants to clean up toxins. There's been a lot of studies in Sweden. Willows were utilized to facilitate microbial degradation of organic pollution, such as sludge. And they found that the willow absorbs the pollutants, and then the shoots are burned and the metals are removed from the ash. They found that cadmium levels were reduced, which is one of the most hazardous heavy metals. Well, there was also some studies. There was a study in Indonesia,
Audrey,
using plant material, and they found that it absorbed a high amount of heavy metals through its roots, limbs, leaves, and stems.
Okay, Audrey, let me ask you something.
Uh-huh.
So there's been a lot of studies done. Are there any, like, you know, anything being actually implemented on such a scale that to be comparable to, say, that Kansas City sewage treatment? Are municipalities actually implementing these?
Okay, so I have a lot of old information, and I have dial-up computer, so I'm not real current, but I remember Michael Allman telling me about Emporia, that he made a visit to the sewage treatment plant in Emporia, and
Emporia, Kansas.
It seemed to me that they were using mushrooms to treat that. If he's listening, maybe he could call in. So I can tell you more about the studies than about the implementation.
Okay.
At this point.
Fair enough.
I'm sorry. Again, there's something called goosegrass herb and canna that were used to remove heavy metals from contaminated soils. Malaysia did a lot of work, and there's a plant called Java or cat's whiskers that was utilized. It's considered to be really valuable in phytoremediation, and in humans, it's also being studied for its anti-tumor potential. So I like the idea that the plant heals the earth and it heals the people as well. There's something called verma remediation, that's using earthworms to degrade toxins. And this also enriches soil macronutrients. I think, like on a small grassroots level, we could use less toxins or no toxic chemicals in our day-to-day life. We could encourage and demand industry reduce their use of toxic chemicals. I think we should ban the application of sewage sludge on agricultural land, period, in our communities.
Now, some places have done that, am I correct?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I'll get to that in just a minute. There's a woman, there's actually a National Sludge Alliance. I have a box of information of people's accounts and information about sludge. There's a woman named Charlotte Hartman, and she offers this advice. Turn it into a local issue, get the press on it, hold your own town board accountable to local public health and safety, because some farmers have sued cities and town boards when their crops or livestock died after sludge was applied on their fields. She said, educate, such as how to increase soil fertility naturally, say no to all sludge. There's several groups. There's a Center for Media and Democracy that was founded to fight corporate PR spin. There's a Center for Health, Environment, and Justice in Falls Church, Virginia. And there's the United Sludge Free Alliance. And they say, you are what you eat, America. And their motto is from toilet to table. Okay, and bans. I'll get to some bans here. Our grain exports are being rejected by European markets if our heavy metals levels are too high. So some folks need an economic incentive to make changes. In 16 California counties, as of 2001, so there's probably a lot more, there were 44 municipalities in New Hampshire and 16 California counties that banned the land application of sewage sludge. The Food Rights Network, they won a battle to prevent the city of San Francisco from dumping sludge in gardens, created to teach children about growing healthy food. And interestingly enough, the Food Rights Network was referred to as an eco-terrorist group. Hmm. There's bans in Switzerland. That was the first European country to ban sludge on agricultural land. And Sweden and Denmark followed behind.
Okay.
I have a quote here.
All right.
Okay. So there was a singer, an environmental singer named Dakota Sid Clifford that I heard years ago. And he quoted Utah Phillips. And Utah Phillips said, "People keep coming to me and saying, the planet is dying, the planet is dying." And Utah Phillips said, "The planet isn't dying, it's being killed, and the people doing the killing have names and addresses."
All right. Well, I love a good Utah Phillips quote. I want to ask you, though, our time is going very quickly, so I want to get to what motivated you so passionately about this issue. What's your personal story?
Let me preface it by saying I have a whole new farm now, so none of my products are tainted. But in the summer of 2000, unmarked trucks started dumping some kind of substance on the land, on the field adjacent to my farm. I had a 3.5-acre farm. I had 75 peach trees, organic gardens. It was a beautiful little piece of paradise. And this truck kept coming and dumping some. We didn't know what it was. And my baby was 2 at the time. He was playing outside as a truck dumped right next to our property line. So this went on, and I called the health department, and the health department came out, and they didn't know anything about it, and they chased the truck down, and we found out that it was from the city of Baldwin, and it was municipal sludge that was being dumped. So immediately we stopped eating the food from our land. I do farmer's market. I stopped selling at the market. I make herbal tinctures. I stopped. Essentially, my livelihood was cut away. I called Kansas Department of Health and Environment, and a very nice man came out and collected samples to take to be tested. He submitted the samples before they could be tested. KDHE, a supervisor, intervened and said, no, we can't do that. So I spent a long time fighting and questioning and exploring. And I talked to the city administrators. I talked to everybody I could think of to talk to. I talked to the EPA. And essentially, it was sanctioned by the EPA. So there was nothing I could do. My hands were tied. I believe in this country, money buys justice, and I couldn't afford a lawyer, so there was no justice. I had to move. So, which is okay. I have a bigger farm, a more beautiful farm, but it's not okay. I mean, because the land was degraded. So that's what motivated me. Oh, my two-year-old, I have three children. My baby had a lymph node that turned red and purple, and it burst, and he had to have surgery to remove his lymph node at that time. So my children's health was at risk. And it wasn't just an economic situation for me, because my land was sacred. It was, I love that piece of earth. So.
Sure. Okay, well, I really appreciate you sharing your story, and you reliving that hard time for us. But I think you did a really remarkable job of laying the issue on the line there so folks can kind of understand it. And, you really did a wonderful job, and I appreciate the research you've put into this and helped folks to understand maybe what's at stake here and giving people something to think about. So I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and any final words before I let you go?
No, I want to remain hopeful that we're waking up and that we're going to protect the planet and that we won't let this continue. So I don't want to leave folks with feelings of pessimism and hopelessness. I really feel like people are becoming more conscious and we can put a stop to what we're doing to the planet.
Okay, well, Audrey Klopper, organic farmer and herbalist, thank you so much for sharing your story with Eco Radio KC and our listening community tonight.
Oh, thanks for listening.
All right. We'll catch up with you later. Keep in touch.
Bye.
Bye. And, that was Audrey Klopper. And full disclosure, she is a friend of mine, and I was familiar with her story and contacted her when I went to this farm owned by the city up north of the river to get her take on that. So a couple of things on environmental front on KKFI this week. Tomorrow at 6 o'clock on Radioactive Magazine, they will be touching on the trifecta resistor. We touched a little bit about on that last week. There's three areas of resistance, one of which is the contamination of the old nuclear weapons plant at Bannister Road. So that's at 6 o'clock. And then at 6:30, Janet Redman speaks on the EPA, the new EPA rules regarding carbon emissions, the outcry from the industry. But there's also people who are concerned about climate change that aren't exactly dancing in the aisles either. So on Counterspin, we'll help you sift through that tomorrow evening at 6:30. And as you heard earlier, Survival Sunday, there's a Wednesday morning look back at the No Nukes rally held at the Hollywood Bowl in 1979 on the Pacifica Radio Archives from the Vault. That's 5 a.m. Wednesday. And then the Craig Volland on mercury pollution at noon on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, we've got the Beehive Design interview with WDRT, traveling art exhibit dealing with the struggle for environmental justice in Central and South America. That's Thursday at noon, followed up at 12:30 by GM No, Genetically Modified Democracy on Making Contact. And, of course, don't forget about Bioneers on Friday morning at 9:30. We're going to hear some spots, and then we'll hear from Richard Mabian.
At least half and probably more of the top predatory fish in U.S. lakes are seriously contaminated with mercury. This menace is analogous to climate change, and it has the same basic cause. Craig Volland is the air quality chair for the Kansas Sierra Club. He's been studying this issue since 1990, and he gives us a report on the next All Souls Forum, Wednesday at noon, right here on KKFI.
Hello, everyone. This is Richard, and there's a lot going on in the state of Kansas, and I really wanted to bring everybody up to date. And I'm sorry I wasn't able to do this show live, but it's so important that I didn't want to miss it. So I had the Sierra Club's legislative aide to come in and meet with me. He's been here before. Last time he's here, I think he had two or three little cute girls with him. And they talked about that, what was that, the Powerade or something like that. Zach, introduce yourself. Let people know who you are again.
Sure. Yeah, Zach Pastore. I'm the proud lobbyist for the Kansas Sierra Club, working on behalf of Environmental Voice up at the State House of Topeka.
All right. Now, you heard him say proud. I like that in him. And, you know, Zach is actually, I can say he's a youngster because I'm an oldster. So he's a youngster, but he's got a lot of enthusiasm. He's been doing a fantastic job for the Sierra Club here in the state of Kansas. And for me in particular, because, you know, the Sierra Club is an organization that has pretty much maintained its working apparatus to issues that are not necessarily related to what's happening in our inner cities. And just here lately with the work that we just got done over there in Wyandotte County with BPU and the court decree that we got as far as the coal fire plants over there, that even I started becoming more aware and I could use the word educated to environmental circumstances and issues that goes on in this state. But here lately, God boy, the state house up in Topeka has been engaged, thoroughly engaged in environmental circumstance and issue. And Zach has been doing a fantastic job because he's been educating me. And that's not an easy thing to do because I'm a tough nut to crack. You know, I'm old school. You know, I still believe in things that should have died with blue suede shoes. So when you're able to start really reaching me as far as new and improved ideas are concerned, you have to be doing a good job. So, Zach, I done gave you all the glory that you're going to get. That's it. I agree with you. You should be proud for what you're doing. So let's just start from the top. I'm going to let you, because that's the best way to do it, is just give us some kind of opening statement on what the heck is going on in Topeka.
Sure, yeah. And I absolutely agree with what you're saying, that some of the things that are happening broadly in as far as state issues are hard for us to sometimes really pinpoint down in our local community. I mean, we're talking about the species of prairie chickens and making sure that they're well protected in our state and what level of control that has. The federal control coming in and protecting our prairie chickens or other non-migratory wildlife. We're dealing with wind energy, which we have abundance of in Kansas, right. But for folks in the urban setting, I mean, do you see very many windmills?
You don't see windmills. I mean, that's not an issue. So when they first came out, we thought we'd have them on rooftops and stuff, but no such deal.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I mean, having the message of environment hit home is a big thing.
Right.
Because if they're not seeing it every day in their community or hearing about it, if they're going to, in the morning to get some coffee or something or over the kitchen table at night, then they're not going to be paying too much attention to it.
Right.
Right? They got other bigger issues that they're worried about. So You know, but at that said, these larger issues that happen in the state, we need some input and engagement on, because largely they're working against us. These environmental issues that have been happening at the state level haven't been improvements to environmental issues for the most part.
Okay.
They've been trying to take a step backwards.
Okay.
So that's something we can talk about more in detail on with specific issues. Now, I'm not going to say all of it's been bad. There have been some positive gains to be made. Energy efficiency, one of those things. Keeping our 20% renewable energy goal by 2020, which we'll talk more in detail about. But some of those things of how can we protect land less. You know, one of the bills that they brought forth was, well, if you put your land in a trust, protect it for the legacy, you know, Richard maybe in legacy family farm or something like that, or your land that you want to protect from development so don't become a strip mall or whatever, you can do that right now, but they wanted to make it so you could end it once you died. Once you died, your land would go up for sale again.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. And it's your land. It's your rights. You should be able to protect that in perpetuity, meaning forever, if you want to.
So who brought that bill up? I'm curious. I mean, where did that come from?
Well, you know, there's folks, a legislator in particularly out of southwest Kansas.
That's unreal.
Doesn't want to see people, you know, tie up property rights from the grave. Well, wait a second here. Those are those people's property rights, whether they're still living or not.
See,
you know?
Now I understand why Zach is here. I'm telling you now, these are the kind of things that I started hearing them talk about, and I started going, you know, nobody's talking about that. I don't hear anybody around my vicinity talking about those kind of issues. I mean, you're talking about if a person wanted to leave their land to their family from now to forever, that once they die, that agreement is gone.
Well, yeah, right.
They want to take it away.
Right. If you want to put it into just a nature preserve or just a farm with no buildings on it, you can do that now, but they want to try to get rid of that.
That's unreal. I want to back up here before we go any further. Let's talk about these farmers. How much are farmers getting paid? Because we was talking about windmills, like you don't see windmills in your next door neighbor's houses and stuff like that. But out there in western Kansas, you do see windmills on farmers' property. Do they get paid?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, across the state, it's millions of dollars every year these farmers are getting in lease payments. There's $1 million that are getting allocated to communities to build a school because they have that new industry right there in their town.
See, again, this is where, by being in eastern Kansas, we lose out on this. I mean, I'm a dirt farmer. Now, ain't no problem with farmers now. Come on now, I love farmers. See, we need farmers to live and survive. But I'm a dirt farmer, and I'm having difficulties. We having droughts. Okay. I can't grow the caliber of crops I was able to grow 10 years ago. So I'm trying to figure out, how's my family going to survive? I mean, I've been hearing all the rumors about farmers, new generations leaving and moving to the city. Yeah. But now you're telling me that a dirt farmer that have been having difficulties growing crops can find himself in a position that land could be rented out for $1 million to put some windmills on it? My God.
And you still do your farming.
And still do your farming up under the windmill.
Yeah, these cows, you see cows run around these windmills and all that. They didn't seem seemingly bothered. Now, you know, I mean, there are some concerns as far as space and maybe bird migrations and stuff like that that we ought to consider.
Oh, yeah, just a really big thing I got to be concerned about, the birds flying over my yard. For $1 million, they can fly over my yard all they want to. I hire somebody to clean the crap off my roof.
This has been a huge economic stimulus for people where towns are drying up. You know, people are moving away from western Kansas to bring some economic productivity in their area for their community.
That's unbelievable.
It's a big deal. And I think the legislators are getting that. We've seen legislators vote on this 20%.
Okay, let's go there. Let's talk about the 20%.
Yeah. This,
sorry, folks. I had to get that in there.
That's the foundation for why the vote came to where it was being. And we won the vote this year in the Kansas legislature, six times, three times directly, three times indirectly. But the message was clear. that western Kansans as well as eastern Kansas definitely agree that wind energy is so productive for our state, both economically but also for a clean energy future.
Okay.
Right? So you're getting, big money. And so you had Western Kansas come up during these votes and saying, yeah, we support 20% renewable energy because we're seeing the jobs and the money it's bringing back home.
Yeah.
And, it doesn't use any water.
Right.
You know,
it's strictly money.
Right.
And I want to come to you on this because this is one of my concerns. Is you just mentioned that our legislators from eastern Kansas are voting in favor of these bills, too. But what bothers me, and I think this is important, those people who are voting have no vested interest in whether it's out there or not, because they don't have windmills here in eastern Kansas. So if they're voting based on their constituents, then that may not even be an issue to their constituents. Feel me? And that's the reason I'm saying this, because they're voting because they're Democrats. They're just going with the party. There's not no, I had to educate myself about this process to be able to know what the heck I'm doing. They're just voting because that's what Democrats are doing. Well, what if Republicans replace them? What if, as the state is becoming a Republican state, what if we lose our Democratic representatives out of eastern Kansas, Wyandotte County, and some Republicans get hired? You know, Hispanics don't necessarily vote Democrat, and Wyandotte County is becoming an Hispanic community. So what have we lost? That, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, first of all, there's a few things that come to mind. You know, this environmental issues, you know, a lot of these environmental issues, they're not a political issue. They shouldn't be a political issue.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you're, you're a Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, or whatever. You know, this is, as far as living on this earth, in this home, wherever, we need the basics. Food, water, shelter, you know, and then we can go beyond that. But if we're not getting the water, the food, if we're not having clean air to breathe, that, I mean, all those things, we depend on our environment every day.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter, you know, the environment is not discriminating against you. You know, whether, you know, what a party you are or whatever, who you are. You got to rely on that if you're a human being.
All right, period.
Okay. Now, wait a second.
Yeah.
But I don't think necessarily the Democrats are just going with the flow on it. I think they understand how incredibly beneficial this is to the state. Totally.
Okay.
I mean, Kansas is reeling in a little money about this.
Yeah.
We're diversifying our energy portfolio, so we don't got to rely on 2/3 of our energy coming from Wyoming.
Right.
We can get here in our own state.
Here's my concern.
Okay.
They are not representing their constituents because their constituents are totally clueless about what we're sitting there talking about. They are playing a political game with each other. They're playing a political game in Topeka. And my concern is they're not educating the people in the neighborhoods. Mm. And if we want to really move it from being a political issue, then they should be investing some time in education. Anytime we've had a Sierra Club function, the one thing I've noticed is that elected officials from those rural areas show up. I have never seen an elected official from Wyandotte County at any of those sessions, and that is state, as I said, senators and representatives. I've never seen one, and that is my concern of how do we get to people to say that we should be demanding that our representatives start educating themselves so that this can get past being political, past being something that somebody told you can make some money on, and move it to being something that's just the right thing to do. Feel me?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm with you.
Now my issues, and you didn't know how this conversation was going to go. That's why I don't like to script anything. So we can just go with the flow. And one reason that I'm really staying on top of what's going on in Kansas now is we had a session, 40th year or whatever thing up there in Topeka, and Zach was there. I took a young man with me from Kansas City. His name is Fred White, because I'm trying to get him introduced into what's going on now in this too. And one of the sessions that really caught me was when this professor from I think Washburn or something stood up and talked about the water issue in the state of Kansas and how the aquifer is destined to be dried up by 2060. And what that means to those of us who live here in the state of Kansas. And I started realizing how all this discussion, and then I found out that the state was engaged in a 50-year strategic planning about water.
Yeah.
In eastern Kansas, folks are not engaged in the conversation. So you got western Kansas and our elected officials sitting up at Topeka making decisions about water for us without our input. Now, does that make any sense? Tell me about it.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think the water issue's hitting western Kansas is a lot quicker, right? Talking about 20 years or less water supply for some communities. The eastern Kansas are going to have a little bit more water supply down the road, a little bit more precipitation. It's supposed to get wetter on this side with climate change, where it's supposed to get drier out there. So they're feeling a little bit more. But the fact that we're not talking about engaging with locals and communities on this side of the state about water, I think is a big deal. Okay. And so, I mean, that's going to be the biggest environmental issue I think we face, ongoing with climate change. But
I agree. I went out to Kmart yesterday. Of course, it was in Missouri off Independence Avenue, but still all Kmart's. And you know how they have those flowers out front that they sell in the little boxes? They had the water constantly running. The parking lot was wet. Water constantly running.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting up going, I'm listening to these people talking about weed water drying up. Say, people, I don't know if you knew this, but the state of Kansas got a bill up there in Topeka where they want to build a pumping system that's going to pump water from the Missouri River across the state of Kansas. Forget eastern Kansas. Pump it from the eastern part of the state across our state, through our homes, past everything to the western part of the state that has a price tag of $12 billion. $12 billion taxpayers' dollars. And we aren't engaged in the conversation. I mean, that don't make any sense, man. You're talking about marching on Monsanto about putting genetically altered seeds. We ought to be marching on our elected officials in eastern Kansas saying, what are you doing? Where is our representation? I mean, how can they? They should have been scared to put a bill like that. I know it's just sitting there, but they should have been scared. Brownback says he wants to outlaw corn being grown in the state of Kansas. And we don't have no input in that. I mean, we're going to import our corn now. We're not going to grow it here no more so we can save the water for the food and the pigs and the cows. Right. I'm not knocking that. I mean, I'm just showing we got to do something, but we're not in the conversations.
Right. And, I mean, how backwards is that? We're going to just divert the water from the Missouri River, take some river water that goes to other people and other places, ship it out of a place that we're highly using water with animal agriculture, corn agriculture. I mean, this is an equity issue. This is a justice issue because you got 20%, only 20% of the farmers use irrigated agriculture in our state, using 80% of the state's water. 20% of only of the farmers using 80% of the state's water. That doesn't seem quite right.
Yeah, and I don't want to cause a class issue here. So, and Jax, excuse me, and audience, excuse me. I mean, we've already extended my time, but I knew this was going to happen. I love you. You have to continue to come back. I got to have you here about once a month, man, to keep, because this stuff is hitting every day.
Right.
It's hitting every day. But I just wanted to kind of share this with everyone. I'm going to make water our issue, my personal issue this year, the rest of this year, and try to see how we can keep people informed and abreast of what's going on. You know, we need to be educating our children, our grandchildren. I just came back from Georgia and brought my grandchildren with me. And on the way up here, I showed her one of those water rigs that's out there on the farm. You know what I'm talking about? That they use the water thing.
Oh, yeah.
I showed her one. I said, you see that? She said, yeah. I said, she's 10 years old. I said, I want you to remember that when we get back. Why? Just remember it, because I'm going to have you look up aquifer. And so when you look it up, you'll know what apparatus they use with that water that's in the aquifer. So we need to start educating our future generation about stuff that the rest of us didn't know. When I used to see those things out there, I didn't know that they was getting water from the aquifer. I just thought they had a water hose hooked up to their house and they turned it on and just let it go. You know?
Yeah.
So I'm saying we have to start making sure that our future generations are growing up with that. Now, we're running short on time, so I'm going to let you dictate what we talk about from here to the end, and I'll keep us up when we get down to a couple of minutes. Okay, so go ahead.
Well, I mean, just kind of on the last point there, this is million-year-old water that's been underground,
yes.
and we're using it out of the ground just like, hey, it was meant for us kind of thing, you know? And so just thinking about how that implicates a sustainable society and what that means. You know, if we can be sustainable to where we're not counting on million-year-old either fossil fuels in the ground, but we can rely on what we have and make our processes, everyday, daily lifestyles matched where it's going to be friendly enough to we're not going backwards. We're not going to sacrifice future opportunities for future generations.
Okay.
And, I mean, part of that's an environmental problem, but I think it's also a people problem, too.
Yeah, it's definitely
a
people.
And so, you know, talking about education, getting kids started from the very beginning, getting people that are already, you know, at their job, at home, to make some of the changes where we all as a society can move forward. And being more eco-friendly, being more friendly with each other, I think some of these problems will, you know, maybe not go away.
Right.
But we'll be in a lot better spot than what we are now, you know.
You people out there listening, I know y'all just busting at the bit with questions you want to ask. And unfortunately, Zach is not going to be with us so that you can ask those questions. But when this recording is through and we come back on air, I'm going to open up the line. So that if you have some questions, you can get them to me. I do the best I can with answering them. At least we'll talk about them. At least we can make them more known. And if there's any hot button items, I'll make sure I get them to Zach. And the next time we have him on, we'll make sure that we'll answer those questions first. So, if you had to give me your top item that you would be concerned about, we're out of session now, aren't we?
Yes.
Okay. When do we go back in?
It starts back up in January. So we got this all the off season.
Elections and the whole bit. Boy, so we don't have to be that concerned about any decisions being made because those have already occurred, right?
Correct, but sometimes the most important part is the off season.
Right.
So everybody's on the same page when we come back around to the legislative session.
Okay, so we're gonna try. So what do you think we should be focused in on as far as making sure we're keeping our audience here on the air abreast of what's going on? What are some of the areas?
Sure. We talked about renewable energy, standards, our 20% goal by 2020.
What does that mean?
Basically, utilities that are charged with getting you electricity, they get it, they burn their energy and create electricity. Well, they can get that from fossil fuels or they can get it from renewable clean energy, like wind and solar and hydropower and some of those things. Well, they put a goal in 2009 of getting to 20% by 2020.
20% means that a utility company, 20% of its energy will be produced by renewable energy.
Correct.
Correct.
And I think, I mean, 20%, that's a good goal. And we're on the way to meet the goal. But, you know, if we're talking about larger issues of climate change, about building an economy with in-state energy supply that's clean, that doesn't use very much water in the state of Kansas, I think we should go up to 50%. You know, we need it bad.
Ooh.
I know. Yeah,
that's fine because with Kansas being ranked in one of the top three states as far as wind,
right.
Even though that's western Kansas now, the income that can be produced from the creation of wind can have a benefit for the whole state.
Whole state and the whole country.
The whole country.
Yeah.
Now, I'm concerned about the state.
Yeah, right.
Because
I've
got a little young buckets running, nut buckets running around that don't have jobs.
Right.
And don't see jobs for the future. And I want to make sure that we have some kind of plan on the table that's going to be sending jobs this way. Okay, we're down to our last minute or so here, so I'm going to let you go ahead.
I'd say, hey, Richard, I think the big thing here is charting out a course for a good future. okay. for future generations. So when we have the baby boomers, you know, get the point that they're going to retire, that we got a new generation ready to take over and lead it in a positive direction. Now, the biggest thing, the kind of elephant in the room here is climate change.
Right.
You know, I mean, what is the future going to look like when we come down that road, you know, 20 years, we already seen some funky things happen on with extreme weather events, droughts, and fires and floods and all that. So we need to come up with a plan now so we can be on the right foot going in the future. So Kansas developing a climate action plan would be a good thing. Right now we're burying our hands and saying that climate change isn't happening
at
the State House.
Right.
We need to turn that conversation around as what can we do about it.
Okay. All right. Well, Zach, as usual, time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
Okay. And I always enjoy having you here. I'm going to have you back. I'm going to try to have you here at least once a month so you can keep us abreast of what's going on. I appreciate you. Keep doing what you're doing. Stay in there and fight for it.
Hey, Richard, pleasure.
Always. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.